Hi, welcome everyone. This is Nicole Bradford, and you are on the Transformative Technology podcast, where we talk to leading thinkers and innovators who are working on subjects that are really relevant to our focus, which is innovators and entrepreneurs who are leveraging tech to support mental health, emotional well-being, and human thriving. And as you know, we look around the world for people who are thinking about things that are relevant to the development or deployment of these types of technologies. And so our guest today is Stephen Downes. And Stephen is a specialist in online learning and new media. For over 25 years, he's been in the field and he has deployed a series of progressively more innovative technologies. He's done multi-user MUDs, which is like, you know, as you guys all know, my background's in gaming, and so the original MUDs were really the start of this entire industry. And he was in open online communities in the 2000s, and he's done personal learning environments and after that. And he's really well known for his daily newsletter, OLD Daily, which is distributed to thousands of subscribers around the world. And one of the things that is near and dear to my heart is the work that he's done with Massively Online Open Courses. And as you guys all know, my background with Massively Open Online Games. So we have a lot of affinity there. So thanks so much, Stephen, for joining us today. I really, really appreciate your time. Would you, I'd love to start with, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and your background?
Okay, well, thank you for inviting me, first of all. It's a pleasure to be here and to be able to talk to you and to your audience. About me, well, I live in a small town out in the country, halfway between Ottawa and Montreal, and I'm in that town right now. In fact, looking out my window, where it's a nice day, but there's still snow on the ground, which makes me unhappy. When I work, which is probably too much of the time, as you said, I specialize in online learning and new media. My background is actually in philosophy. That's what my degrees are in, although I also have a background in news media. And I've done a lot of work in computer science, computer technology, and as well as in education, educational theory, pedagogy, things like that. So where I am is where those four domains kind of merge into one single mishmash of media, education, technology, philosophy. And the approach that I take, and this is reflected in many of the choices that I've made of things to study online, you talk about MUDs and stuff like that, I don't want to say networking because that's not quite the right thing, but networks, chaotic systems, maybe, although that's not really the way I'd want to phrase it, communities, societies, but also, philosophical problems like how we know things, how are we conscious, and educational problems like what is knowledge and what is learning.
Wow. There's so many things that I'm interested in that. And I love that you have such a broad background, because I think it's in the intersection of things that you see things that, that might not be obvious to other people. So I would love to talk a little bit more about how people learn, and also how people might learn how to be human. This kind of ties to the consciousness side, and how people might learn emotional and social skills. What do you think is going to happen over the next 5 to 10 years with what we were learning, how we are learning, and how that interacts with the technologies that we have?
Oh, there's 8 to 10 facets to that question.
I know, I'm sorry.
let's back up a step and ask ourselves what we think knowledge is, because that's basically what learning is about, is knowledge, right? And the traditional, what some philosophers call folk psychological picture of knowledge, is that it's like sentences in the brain. And that picture is, in my opinion, and I would say in the opinion of most researchers and philosophers today, that picture is wrong. Mm-hmm. And a big part of my own work is, trying to articulate what it is instead of that. A theory that I've been working along with many other colleagues is based on the idea that knowledge is the organization of our neural states. To know something is to be organized in a certain way, which isn't really very helpful because, you can't really introspect your own internal mental organization. So another way of saying the same thing is to say that to know something is to recognize. It's like if you go to the train station and your mother comes walking in through the train station, you recognize your mother. And you say, yes, I know that that's my mother. And what's interesting here is, first of all, there's no, you don't have a set of criteria or rules that you use to recognize your mother. Right, it's not, she has gray hair, she has a blue bonnet on, she's wearing the gray sweater I gave her last year, right? It's not like that. It's just, you see her, you recognize her. Now, what's happening there is that when you have that perceptual experience, the organization of your mind is, if you will, activated by that. And that's kind of a hand-wavy way of describing it. I sometimes think of it as like snap to attention. But basically, a certain pattern of neurons, connected neurons, fire up, and that is the experience of recognizing someone. So that's what knowledge is, in short form. So what is learning then? And learning really is training ourselves to organize our neural connectivity, if you will. In other words, training ourselves to be able to recognize things. There's a simple short way of doing it, which isn't very reliable, and that's memorization, right? But most of the things that we want to be able to recognize aren't the sort of things that we would memorize, because we want to be able to recognize novel situations. I still want to recognize my mother even if she bought a new coat while she was gone, for example. So it's more about having the capacity to, I don't want to say categorize experiences and things like that, but developing your recognition capacity in general. Mm-hmm. So learning is something that everyone does every minute of the day. Human brains are learning machines. They're recognition machines. They're perception machines, right? That's what they do. And in fact, one psychologist said, basically what a human brain is a prediction machine.
Right.
It creates patterns out of perceptions and then applies those patterns to create expectations of future events, which is a bit hand-wavy again, but just to get the idea.
Right.
So I see learning in general as not cramming facts, not memorizing things, not content knowledge or any of those sorts of things. Rather, learning is more like exercise. When I say, I'm not referring just to myself. I'm referring to, you know, many other people who've been working on these ideas for a lot longer than I have and with more expertise than I have. But learning is a lot like exercise. From something simple like learning a language by going out there and speaking the language and living among people who speak that language, to learning to be a scientist by doing experiments and actually working with other scientists, to learning to drive by getting into a car and driving it. So the experiential is very important, but not just the experience, not just having the experience, but having the experience in such a way that you're creating patterns of connectivity in the brain that allow you to recognize new and novel events in a useful way.
Right. Well, so one of the things that, one of the ways that I found you was through the Pew Internet publications, and they were asking about digital wellness in the future, or well-being in a tech-enhanced future. And there were several experts on the page or in the report, and they described a variety of different sensibilities about it. But you, they pulled you out for a particular quote as it relates to contentment. And the thing that I love that you said is, you mentioned sort of like what the challenges are. And then you said that the vast majority of human ambitions and objectives are more noble. People desire to educate themselves and communicate with others and share their experience and create networks of enterprise, commerce, and culture. And I really, one, I love that because that's what I think too. especially being in the Valley right now, there's a lot of discussion around unintended consequences of the social networks. And I think people are becoming very, the people who are thoughtful about these things are becoming very tentative, I think, in how they think about what we can do with technology. And then the people who are not thoughtful about it are just doing what they want anyway. And so what we focus on as a community is like, how do we use technology specifically, not just as a byproduct, but specifically stimulate and support that desire for education, deep communication, sharing of deep experiences, and then creating these networks. And so that's how you came across our radar. And so I'm wondering, what are some of the things when we're talking about the learning framework, and we're talking about these like truly human desires? What do you think the sort of like the next generation of technology might be, where we get beneath the surface of I find Facebook to be very surface level and very 2D. It's sort of like 2D web, in the sense that you can't actually, when people flame each other, they're not actually getting the feedback loop where they, that is sort of evolved in us to be able to understand how we're impacting other humans. Like, where do you think this is going, and what sort of technologies, do you see or do you hope for, that would take those basic desires to facilitating them to a deeper level?
Yeah, sites like Facebook, they took this desire on the part of people. I don't really like the word desire in this context, but it'll have to do, to communicate and connect and interact and create and build. They took this and they took advantage of it basically for their own commercial purposes. First of all, as the big database they could mine, but then, as something that they could attempt to manipulate, either for the benefit of advertisers or even for, the benefit of other clients, shall we say. And we know that they did, emotional manipulation studies and things like that, changing the stream and measuring what the emotional reaction would be on the part of people who were exposed to that news stream. And this has been the model of the internet at this point. And, you know, it's funny because I sit here and you know, I've been on the internet long enough, I can contrast what we have now with those early days. Mm. You know, where we had individual websites, and that was the way we communicated with each other. And we linked to each other, and there were things like blog rolls and, web circles and or wheels. And, it was a different kind of environment and a different kind of sharing. And, you know, there was one website way, 25 years ago, basically organized around written around the theme, something wonderful is going to happen. It's a reference to a science fiction book by Arthur C. Clarke talking about the next evolution of humanity. But it was also the idea that, gee, now that we have this way of communicating with each other, we can create something greater than there was before. And this hasn't gone away, this feeling. You know, it's the sort of thing that Tim Berners-Lee talks about and is working toward even now. You know, and so what I'm seeing, and I can't say whether it'll be successful or not, but what I'm seeing is a lot of people working to decentralize online technologies to kind of get back to that original state where instead of being all collected into this one service like Facebook and commercialized and monetized, we were back to having our own individual online presence and connecting with who we wanted to and how we wanted to or when we wanted to. And so that our discourse would be less industrial and commercial and more personal and productive and creative. Will that happen? And that's a hard question. Some of the technologies, people talk about blockchain all of the time, which seems like the opposite of what I was just talking about, but some of the technologies behind blockchain in building decentralized consensus-based networks seem to be pointing to the possibility that, yeah, maybe that can happen. Mm-hmm. There's multiple forces pulling the internet in different directions. The forces of commercialization and commodification aren't going to go away. If there's money to be made, people will be trying to make it. Whether or not that benefits people. On the other hand, there's a certain amount of tolerance people will have for this kind of exploitation. It's a bit like the practice of medicine in the late 1800s, where there was a promise of something there. We had this sense that, hey, this might work. But we hadn't had the big discoveries yet. And there were a lot of people selling literally snake oil.
Right.
Right. And that's kind of what we have a lot of today, is this technological snake oil. I don't mean it in a strict pejorative sense. I mean it in the literal sense that, it's people trading on the hope and the ambition that people have for this new technology for a quick buck and right. souring the whole well in that process.
Right. Well, so some of the things that I think about in terms of, learning and learning what's mm-hmm. going to be really important, which is, I think, how do we treat each other? Because I actually don't think that, a lot of times in the, especially here in the context that I mentioned to you, there's mm-hmm. a lot of nostalgia, like, there was this great golden age. And I think there was a golden age on the internet. I think, in terms of wider society, I don't actually think we've ever had a golden age of human and communication across groups. You might have had it within a group or within a tribe or within a small subset of a tribe, but as soon as you slice it in another way, based on gender or race or tribe or whatever, I don't think that there was this, you know, I don't think that there was this golden age. And so I think a lot about how can we use technology to teach people, to help skill people for how they relate to themselves. So how do they be? How do they feel? How do they become? Because I don't actually think we really know. And some people know, but not everybody knows. And even people who you would think know don't know. So how do we skill people to, you know, do that with themselves, and then also how they relate to one another? Like, I was reading right now I've been working on, you know, right now most people, when they're talking about emotion recognition and human emotion, it's really about, you know, either a her situation where we have some AI lover, or it's Skynet, or it's call centers, or it's neuromarketing. You know, like that's the purpose for understanding how humans are feeling. But I think there's a possibility of using technology to teach people how to be with one another. And the reason why I think that's relevant is it's sort of like sometimes when I put that premise forward, people have said, oh, isn't that sad that we don't already know this? And it's kind of like, well, you don't expect babies to come out of the womb speaking complete sentences in French just because they have vocal cords. You know, the vocal cords are the mechanism, but the language is the skill. And so similarly, we come out of the womb with emotions. We don't come out of the womb with emotional intelligence. And so, you know, one example is, you know, I was looking at a study the other day that where this researcher, they have they're working with teams. They put a little robot on the table, and periodically during a team discussion, during a gap, the robot says something like, oh, oops, I made a mistake. And and the number of ideas that the team comes up when this piece of technology that they all know isn't human admits to making a mistake, then the humans are have a lower level of caution with one another about a lower level of caution with one another about taking risks. So you can have a robot increase psychological safety on a team, which ties with Google's research of like what were the highest performing teams. It wasn't the ones that had the smartest people on it. It was the ones that had the highest level of emotional safety, which was created by the leader, the team lead. And so now they're looking for that as, you know, as one of the qualities that they're hiring or promoting for. So I think that there's all sorts of little ways, you know, that we can start to use technology to help people, help people in these ways so that when the humans are together, whether it's, online or in the real world, they are better at being a human together. And so I'm really curious about when we talk about learning and all of your experience with MOOCs and MUDs, like what do you think we might be able to do with that? Do you think that that is fertile ground?
Yeah, that's, again, there's a bunch of interesting points there. You know, and that's one of the things about the early internet that everyone's nostalgic for. You know, there were so few people there. Most of the world wasn't there, and it really was one of these nice small groups. And it gets really challenging when you get, into a community that is larger than a small group. There's two things that I've keyed in on over the years. And the one of them, I mean, they're both based on my network perspective, but neither of them really are they don't really derive from it. But the first of this is The idea that each individual person has value in and of themselves. I don't like using the word value there because it makes it sound like the way Kant said it was that each person is an end in themselves rather than as a means to something else. And, you know, if you think about a society is made up of a network of interconnected humans, every one of those humans is an important part of the network because it takes all of those humans. And, you know, from one perspective or another, we might say, well, this one's more important and that one's more important. But that would be as silly as looking at a human brain and saying, well, this neuron is more important or that neuron is more important. You know, the relative importance of one over the other is, you know, negligible compared to the importance of any individual neuron or any individual person in the society. That's really key, you know, and when you get into, you know, environments of conflict, we often see attempts made to dehumanize or to devalue the other side. And, you know, and it's not the sort of thing you can wave a hand and make other people stop doing, but it is the sort of thing that you can kind of catch yourself doing it. You know, and that's what the philosophical training did for me, right? You know, focus on the issue rather than the person, etc. So that's part of it. The second part is what would make a successful network work in the first place? What makes a successful society work? Put aside questions of ethics. Put aside even questions of human nature, what we do naturally, etc. Because, you know, first of all, we're not going to agree on these things, right? We're always going to disagree about what's ethical or what's natural. And secondly, we're looking for more fundamental underlying principles. Principles that could describe networks of people or networks of neurons or ecosystems, forests, nature, whatever. And there's a few that are really important. One, and a lot of people talk about this, is the need for diversity. And, you know, you think of diversity, you know, as you know, one of these political things. But if you think about it, again, separate it from the ethical, the political. If everybody was saying the same thing, how could we have a conversation? We could not. If everybody was saying the same thing, how could we learn something new? We could not, right? The possibility of progress, of adaptivity, indeed even of life itself, is based in diversity. Things that are not diverse, you know, are not living. They're like rocks, right? They're like minerals. Where do you get life? You get diversity. So what I take as a philosophy, if you will, is being open to diversity, being open to the importance of each individual in a society, being open to these experiences. And it's these experiences that help us learn. And so, you see this a lot in, you know, I guess in articles and in videos, documentaries, and that. The storyline, I came to really understand the other side only when I went and lived with them for a certain period of time. You know, things like that. Mm. And I think that's probably the kind of approach. It's not a case of, if you teach them this, they'll be okay. If you teach them that, they'll be okay. It's not that. It's creating as wide and diverse as possible a set of experiences for people, and then having the attitude, the idea of being open to those experiences, embracing those experiences, understand that this is a way of learning and developing not just oneself, but also our capacity to actually live together in a society. And that's the approach that I take.
That's great. I'm wondering, for everyone listening, could you define connectivism for them?
Sure. Connectivism, it's a theory of learning. And we've actually kind of covered it already.
Okay.
It's the thesis that to know is to be organized or connected in a certain way, and that to learn, therefore, is to have the capacity to create, strengthen, or weaken, or traverse those connections. And the idea here of connectivism is that human beings learn by creating connections between neurons. Societies learn by creating connections between human beings, individuals with each other. Organizations learn in the same way. Collections of crickets learn. Murmurations of starlings learn. And so the learning is in the organizing. The learning is in the creation and development of these connections. And then following from that are ways of talking about how we could organize our learning, basically, if we understand that that's what learning actually is.
That is so interesting, because it's sort of like, a lot of times in the Valley, when people are talking about growth hacking and this and that, it's they're talking about networks in mm-hmm. terms of, from a commercial standpoint, and that I have an incredible amount of value that I get from this thing. And so I naturally share it with the people that I want to have higher connections to, or that I want to be connected to. But what you're talking about is sort of like that at such a deeper level, like that network, the way the Valley talks about it, would it be true to say that that is just a symptom of this like deeper learning, network learning, that you're describing? And am I understanding you correctly, where you're saying, if we understand that the creation of these networks is actually the learning process, then we would change how we think about learning, and education to educate or to learn would look differently?
Yeah, in a sense, right? I mean, first of all, the way that I've seen this kind of Valley talk before, right? I'm able to work my network and get this information or that opportunity, etc. And this is you using the other people in your network as a means to an end, which kind of misunderstands the purpose of the network, because the purpose of the network isn't to serve you.
Right. I'm sorry. I didn't mean networking. I meant sort of like the network effects of.
Oh no, I understand that.
Okay, cool.
But it's the people try to take this network effect and turn it around to their own advantage. Right.
Got it.
But it's interesting. An effective, I don't want to say it that way, but the role of a person in a network, or the role of a neuron in a network, isn't to accumulate and gather resources for itself. In fact, it's the opposite. It's to share. So we're helping the network if we're sharing. We're hindering the network if we're not sharing, if we're taking. So you know, there's a bit of a different perspective there. But yeah, I mean, you talked about, you know, we might approach these things differently if we saw, you know, how the network really works, and that's true. But it's not the sort of thing where you can just sort of sit down and say, okay, here are the facts about networks. Now you know how they work. Go out and be a good person. It doesn't work like that. I know it sounds funny when I say it like that, but I've just
I totally understand.
You know, so again, people learn about networks by being immersed in them, by working with them. So the way to get people to learn about networks is to create or better find and help develop networks, help them grow, share with them, make them more effective, invite people into them, and let them have that experience for themselves. And then you don't need to tell them about networks. They will, you know, through that experience, get some understanding of how this works. I know that sounds really hand-wavy, and I wish it didn't. It's kind of hard in a podcast to do that. I want to draw pictures, and I can't.
Right. Well, I hope that this is the beginning of a long connection between the two of us, because I feel that the work that you've done and what you're thinking about, I think that it will. I actually do believe that it will migrate into the design of the technology itself. There's that. So before we, as we're, you know, I only have a little bit more time with you, will you share what is the project that you're working on that you're the most excited about, that people can look up and hear about and follow up on?
Well, that's a hard question.
Sorry. Okay, just one that you know you're about right now in this exact
moment. And it's because I'm sort of between projects right now. I mean, you know this thing they say about lifelong learning? Mm. You actually do have to do that. And so, yeah, I've been heads down digging into things like consensus network-based technology, a little bit about artificial intelligence ethics. I've been working on personal learning environments for a while, and I haven't given up on that. But, you know, I'm kind of on about decentralized systems, but I need to learn a new programming language in order to make that work. Actually, it's not a new programming language. It's an old language, but new frameworks within that language. But the big things, they always stay the same anyways. One big thing is open education, open learning, or as I sometimes say, free learning. And again, it's not simply about making content available to people for free, although it is sort of that. But it's about making the entire content production use, thinking about, et cetera, system open to people. Right now, a lot of people talk, when they talk about educational resources, they talk in terms of producers and consumers, which I think is an inherently wrong model. I think the consumer should be the producers should be the consumers. In basically a consumption production network of learning resources, so that we're all creating and we're all learning. Yeah. And this addresses many of the issues that we have in our current system. The big issue being that right now education still is something that's reserved for a privileged few, and really it should be something that belongs to a society as a whole. Yes. So I'm working on that. What does that mean? Well, partially it means massive open online courses, not MOOCs the way they turned out at Stanford and Harvard and MIT, where they're basically commercial products, but MOOCs
and their as completion rates are so low. It's it's available, but very few people are doing them because the design is kind of horrible.
The design is horrible. I mean, to me, attrition rates are meaningless anyways, right? Again, it's this understanding of learning as a product to be consumed, which is the wrong picture of learning. The original MOOCs that we created before Stanford and Harvard came along were what are called today CMOOCs. And basically, they are the creation of networks of people, of places, of resources, etc., around a certain topic. And then within that network, and this is what makes it a course, we'll have a series of events, usually a series of conversations or maybe talks or whatever. But the idea here isn't that people are supposed to remember all the things that were talked about. The idea is that each person participates in this network. They have, you know, conversations with some, although certainly not all, because it's a massive course, right? But some people, they look at some, but not all of the resources. Each person has their own individual perspective that they create on the subject at hand. And then out of that diversity of perspectives that people have, we have conversations. And out of all of that emerges new learning that nobody had before.
Wow.
That's what we designed. And then, of course, you know, Harvard and Stanford and them take the concept and move it back into a traditional kind of content-based course. So we've been offering MOOCs, I say we, you know, various people around the internet. We've been offering these kind of MOOCs since 2008. I offered one last fall on what I called e-learning 3.0 that looks at some of these new consensus-based mechanisms that I was talking about. So that's the sort of thing that I'm working on now.
So you're kind of, and so the way that that is it true to say that the way that that ties to, you know, are you looking at, or let me ask this, how does that tie to blockchain? Are you, or to tokens? Are you thinking that a CMOOC is, that part of the currency is tokenized?
Okay. I'm not thinking about currencies at all when I think about these kind of numbers. I know that blockchain began as, a financial kind of network, Bitcoin and all of that. And, you know, my reaction to that as well, that just
I don't mean currency in terms of like a traditional currency. Bottom line, we also need a whole bunch of new words because the old words are not sufficient. But I meant it more generally, like, you know, how do people show appreciation or all the different ways that in a system or in a network, there's different types of, for lack of a better word, currencies.
It's a bit different from that. Let's think about what blockchain was intended to solve. Blockchain was intended to solve the problem of how do you have a decentralized financial network when nobody trusts anybody else?
Right.
And that sounds like a really crass and cynical way of looking at the world. But, you know, if you take ethics and politics and that out of it, that's the approach that you have to look at, right? And you can't depend on politics and ethics to get people to do the right thing, because invariably some people will do the wrong thing. They just are bad actors. Yes, as I said in the Pew thing, the vast majority of people want to do the right thing. A small percentage of people do not want to do the right thing. So the question is, how do you make it possible for the vast majority of people to do the right thing without being undermined by this small number of people who want to do the wrong thing, whatever it is? That's the problem blockchain was intended to solve. Forget about the money bit. That's a hard problem. That's a really hard problem. And blockchain solved it by creating incentive-based, consensus-based mechanisms. In the end, I think those mechanisms won't be sufficient. One of the mechanisms, for example, is the desire of people to make money, which leaves blockchain vulnerable to people who don't care if they make money or not. You know, if somebody pours money into the system with the simple purpose of destroying the system, they could. I call that the Joker problem, right? Some people just want to see the world burn. But, you know, consensus and consensus algorithms have been around for a long time. But, you know, you think about that, and part of what came out for me thinking about those sorts of problems last fall was it gives us a different way of talking about some of the things that we're talking about already, like, say, community. What is community? And usually we define community as sameness, right? We all speak the same language, we all wear the same clothes, we all live in the same place. But, you know, that creates us versus others, which is a bad thing. You know, creates conflict, etc. Then we talked about community as connection, and yeah, I like that, but not just any old connection, right? You know, I mean, fascist regimes can be connected by a network of spies. That's probably not what we want. But looking at the problem from the blockchain perspective, I think about the idea of, well, community is consensus. And maybe there's something to that in the sense that a community is a mechanism for helping us do the things that we want to do without being undercut by the people who are bad actors in our community. And that seems kind of right, and I've been pursuing that as an idea. I hope this train's going by here. Probably hear it. Hi, train. So, we get back to, like, the principle that I get back to ultimately is something like what I'm working toward is a world where each person can live their life to the fullest. Yeah. Pursue their own ambitions, whatever those ambitions might happen to be, you know, to the extent, you know, to the greatest extent possible, you know, so long as they're not trampling on other people to do that. And how we get there is this network picture where our societies are not based on hoarding, they're not based on bringing things into ourselves, but rather they're based on, yes, connecting, but also on communicating, and most of all on sharing and being open to the, you know, incredible diversity of experiences in the world. That's what I'm up to. And all of this other stuff is, you know, how can I make the technology work to do that? Can a blockchain picture of community as consensus move us in that direction? Can an open educational resource network move us in that direction? And I think these things do move us in that direction, slowly, incrementally, based on the work of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people. Slowly we move in that direction, but it's hard, and success is by no means certain.
That is, everything that you just said is so aligned with my purpose, why I'm here, what I'm doing. And I just feel so fortunate to have read about you so that I could reach out and have this conversation and you know, really, like, I hope begin a collaboration. You know, in what specific way, I don't know, but I just know that I'm completely down with what you just said.
Cool.
And I'll do anything I can to help.
Well, that
That's
sounds
also
great.
What I'm doing too. Wow. Well, I would love to, we'll get some links on CMOOCs and that sort of thing to include and whatever, and we'll add links, you know, in the,
sure.
With the podcast. And I'm so grateful for your time. I really, really appreciate it. And also all the work that you're doing.
Well, it's my pleasure. You know, I mean, it's, you know, this is what I do. Like, you know, just being able to share these thoughts and ideas is, you know, like I said, what I do.
Cool. Okay. Thank you. Bye.
Bye.